This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
This week on Freakonomics Radio, it is the least beloved activity in most people's workday.
Bad meetings have just been accepted as a cost of doing business.
Are meetings even necessary?
We actually have vastly superior technologies to do exactly the things that people say go on in meetings.
We'll hear from people who study meetings.
I study meetings because I dislike them tremendously.
And people who try to fix meetings.
In my experience, most of our gatherings suffer from unhealthy peace, not unhealthy conflict.
How to make meetings less terrible. That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio right after this hour's news. I'd like you to be particularly open-minded today. I'd like you to entertain the possibility that two absurdly disconnected stories may, in fact, have a deep connection, and that if you're willing to see it through, this connection may yield insights that substantially improve your life. Or not, but let's try. The first story is set in the Okavango Delta in Botswana.
The Okavango is absolutely beautiful. It's the world's largest inland delta. So it's surrounded by desert, and it's this kind of emerald jewel in the middle of sub-Saharan Africa.
Hallie Walker is a PhD student.
I study behavioral ecology at the University of Idaho.
When we spoke, she was in Mozambique.
Yeah, right now I'm studying three species of spiral-horned antelopes.
In the Okavango, Walker was studying a species known as the African wild dog.
So what's amazing about this study site is these dogs have been followed for 25 years. So they are raised with vehicles right there, and they're so habituated, they really don't recognize the vehicle.
This allows the researchers to get close enough to record really good video.
So the recordings are pretty intimate.
In the videos, the dogs lie around, keeping cool in the shade. Sometimes they pile on each other and play. And sometimes the dogs make these strange sounds.
It is really odd. The sounds that they make are unvoiced, kind of like sneezes.
Here's what it sounds like.
So sneezes really only happened in those rally events that I was observing.
And what is a rally event?
Yeah, a rally is, African wild dogs are incredibly social animals, so they spend their whole lives in packs.
In each pack, there are dominant dogs and less dominant dogs. Let's say the pack has just been lying around, and the dominant dog gets up.
And he greets other dogs, just like your dog greets you when you get home from work. They try to recruit other pack members to stop resting and sleeping in the shade to go hunt. And either ends in a successful rally where the whole pack leaves the resting site and goes to hunt, or an unsuccessful rally where they lie back down.
And the sneezes, remember?
The sneezes really only happened in those rally events. The only other sneezes that we observed, was about 15% of them, looked like they were just sneezing because they got dust in their nose.
So what did the sneezing have to do with the rally events? Were they some kind of communication? Well, consider our second story. It's about this person.
Priya Parker, and I'm a group conflict resolution facilitator.
How does one become a group conflict resolution facilitator?
One grows up in a complicated family.
Specifically?
Well, I'm biracial. I'm half Indian, half white American. And when I was 9, my parents divorced and they both remarried other people who were kind of radically different from their original marriage. And they had joint custody. So every 2 weeks, I would go back and forth between these two households, and my mother's household was a kind of Indian and British, Buddhist, atheist, agnostic, liberal, democratic, vegetarian household. And my dad and stepmother are white, American, evangelical, Christian, conservative, Republican, twice-a-week church-going family. And I was part of both families.
So plenty of opportunity for conflict resolution in a family setting. Parker went on to formally study conflict resolution, and she ultimately resolved actual conflicts, or at least tried to, in Africa, India, the Middle East. And these days, she's hired primarily by companies in conflict. Companies, it turns out, often try to resolve their conflicts by holding meetings. And a lot of these meetings are unsuccessful. Why?
There's a belief, sometimes spoken, sometimes unspoken, that all meetings should be de-risked. yes, there is an opportunity to kind of be embarrassed or to lose face. But we have so over-indexed on not wanting that to happen that we've drained the meaning and the relevance out of so many of our meetings.
Have you ever been to a meeting where no one says what they really think? Of course you have.
But, you know, unhealthy peace can be as threatening to human connection as unhealthy conflict. And in my experience, because of the norms of our culture, and particularly in the U.S., most of our gatherings suffer from unhealthy peace, not unhealthy conflict.
So Priya Parker likes to introduce healthy conflict into meetings, to turn the meeting from a time-wasting orgy of passive aggression into a well-oiled decision-making machine. If you were looking for a model to do the same, you could do worse than copying our friends, the African wild dogs. Remember, the sneezes happen when one of the dogs rallies the pack to go hunting. Hallie Walker was trying to discern the difference between a successful rally and an unsuccessful one. It turned out the sneezes were a strong indicator.
In successful rallies, there are about 7 times more sneezes than in unsuccessful rallies.
Could it be that the sneezes are how the dog pack votes on whether to go hunting? That a sneeze means, sure, let's go hunting now. And no sneeze means, nah, let's lie in the dirt for a while.
So our research actually didn't establish any direct causality. That's the kind of subtlety that I definitely want to get across. So we have a very, very strong correlation between the number of sneezes. So it could be that, you know, they've already decided and they're clearing their nasal passages to leave. It is a cue. We know for sure that it's a cue, but we don't know for sure that it's a signal, if that makes sense.
But Walker did find a relationship between the number of sneezes and the status of the dog that attempted the rally.
When a dominant individual was the one that got up and started the motion.
Dominant as in the boss. Picture a meeting at your company. It's being led by the global sales manager.
When a dominant individual started the motion, then it only required 3 sneezes to guarantee success for them to leave the area. And if it was a subdominant individual.
Now picture same meeting, but instead of being led by the global sales manager, it's the assistant to the regional manager.
If it was a subdominant individual, it required more than 10 sneezes for them to leave. So we drew from that shifting quorum threshold that your vote matters, but some votes just matter more. So if the dominant dog wants to leave, it takes fewer individuals to add support to the motion to leave, but it takes a lot more momentum to convince the dominant individual to leave their resting site.
Have you ever been in that meeting? Yes. Yes, you have. You have been in every kind of terrible meeting there is. How do we know? Because we asked Freakonomics Radio listeners for their meeting stories, and here's what you told us.
I have no idea what I'm doing there because it's not relevant to my work at all.
Most of us ended up working late because we had to be in the meeting most of the day.
And to add to that, the guy who invited all of us said, I've got to run, enjoy the meeting, and he just poof, left.
And so they were literally like climbing up on the table and like each had a knee on the table, shaking fists and screaming at each other.
My boss berated me in front of everybody for being disrespectful.
And I didn't really understand, thinking, this is what I've got myself involved in meetings like this.
There are, of course, many kinds of meetings with different rules and customs and outcomes depending on where they're held and with whom. You've got community board meetings and family meetings and the weekly floor meeting in a college dorm. You may belong to a knitting club or a rugby team or a religious group that meets regularly. With such variety, there is no way this episode can be remotely encyclopedic. So we will focus on the most standardized meetings, the ones held by professionals in offices, whether it's a construction company or a tech or healthcare firm, whether it's a nonprofit or an academic or government department, because all those places have a lot of meetings.
The best estimates suggest that there are around 55 million meetings a day in the U.S. alone.
That's Steven Rogelberg.
Most professionals attend approximately 15 meetings a week.
He's an organizational psychologist at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte.
And as you move up the organizational hierarchy, individuals spend more and more time in meetings.
He's written a book called The Surprising Science of Meetings.
Basically, it's the examination of meetings as a workplace phenomenon, trying to understand why they go bad, trying to understand the dynamics that emerge in meetings, and trying to figure out how to make them better.
Which is important because, again, 55 million meetings a day.
And it's not a surprise to find the executive spending, you know, anywhere from 50 to 90% of their time in meetings.
So does that fact mean that the people who end up running companies or institutions are basically the people who are good at meetings?
Oh, I wish that was the case. But no, that does not appear to be the case. Some of the research I do looks at satisfaction with a meeting. And if you survey people immediately after a meeting, one person is invariably more positive than everyone else. And this one person is the meeting leader. The person who's leading the meeting says, hey, this is really good. And why would they feel that, right? They're controlling the whole experience. They're talking the most. So they're like, hey, this is nirvana. But everyone else is reporting much more negative experiences.
So you, in other words, you don't have to be very good to be considered even, let's say, top quintile.
That appears to be the case. So when you consider the fact that too many meetings has been identified consistently as the number one source of frustration at work, the number one time waster at work, you know, research has shown that around 70, 71% of senior managers view meetings as unproductive. Now, this is jarring, right? Because senior managers are the ones calling the most meetings. So if senior managers are calling them unproductive, we know we have a problem. Bad meetings have just been accepted as a cost of doing business. I give these speeches to senior HR leaders and talent leaders across the Fortune 100 companies, and I ask them, how many of you have any content on your employee engagement surveys that covers the topic of meetings? Do you want to guess how many people raise their hands?
2%.
Hey, that's a really good guess. Yes, that's right. And so there is no organizational intentionality around this. And with no organizational accountability, leaders are just part of this system where bad meetings are just the cost of doing business, like the rain is in London. So I study meetings because I dislike them tremendously. I study them because I know it is a source of frustration for so many people.
Okay, so we hold a lot of meetings, even though most people don't like meetings and consider them unproductive. But there's a wrinkle.
Well, we know from the research that people actually want to have some level of meeting activity per day. That if you ask people to design their perfect day, it's very rare that they say zero meetings. And this shouldn't be a big surprise. We know from social psychological research that humans are inherently social creatures. And so there's value of interaction and engagement with others.
So maybe we pretend to dislike meetings even more than we actually dislike them. In any case, just about everyone agrees that meetings could use some improvement. So let's start by taking a step back and asking, what is a meeting exactly?
A meeting is a gathering, let's say two or more people, who assemble for a purpose that's ostensibly related to the functioning of an organization or a group.
All right, that sounds pretty sensible.
Meetings seem to be a communication event that is basically neutral.
That's Helen Schwartzman, an anthropologist at Northwestern University.
You know, it's just a place where you come together, you have a problem, you solve it, you have a decision to make, you make the decision, you whatever. And when you actually study organizations, you find that that's not really the way that it works.
In 1989, Schwartzman published a book called The Meeting, Gatherings in Organizations and Communities.
I would say that meetings are the organization, which is to say that instead of having the meeting as a place to solve problems, we need to have problems and crises and decisions to produce meetings.
We actually have vastly superior technologies to do exactly the things that people say go on in meetings.
That is Jen Sandler, another anthropologist who studies meetings. She's at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
So the question of why we continue to meet becomes really important. So one answer to that is that we don't need to. And the other answer is that that's not what meetings are for. That might be what we tell ourselves that they're for. And most of us have this experience too, where we go into a meeting that is ostensibly to make a decision, but it's clear that that decision has been made prior to the meeting. And then, you know, we might ask as participants in that meeting, why are we even meeting then? We're meeting maybe to legitimize that decision, or for somebody to say that that was a collective decision, even though it wasn't.
Okay, it may not come as a shock to you that meetings do not always serve their advertised purpose, or that there was barely a purpose at all. So let's hear what the experts say about meeting basics. Establishing a goal, setting an agenda, deciding whom to invite, even determining the length. What would you guess is the average length of a meeting?
Magically, the average length across the world is 1 hour, and there's just no reason for that. This is a modern phenomenon that has emerged due to calendaring programs like Outlook and Google Calendar.
So if you could invade everybody's calendar on Earth and have a new preset that was not 60 minutes, what would it be?
I just want the leader to think about how long the meeting should be. So given a set of goals, make a decision, right? This is particularly important given something called Parkinson's Law. And Parkinson's Law is this idea that work expands to whatever time is allotted to it. So if you schedule an hour, it's going to take an hour. But if you schedule 48 minutes, it's going to take 48 minutes. Psychological research shows that when you add a little bit of pressure, it creates more focus and optimal performance. So if this results in you starting your meeting at 1:12 p.m. and ending at 1:50, so be it. You are in control. Make choices.
We go into autopilot and we follow specific scripts and we don't actually think about asking the first question of all meetings, which is, what is the purpose of this meeting?
Priya Parker again. Her book is called The Art of Gathering.
So it's our Monday morning staff meeting. It's our Wednesday afternoon sales meeting. That is not a purpose. That is a category. So what is the primary purpose? What is your desired outcome of the staff meeting? If you are having this on a Monday morning, what do you want to be different for this week? If we weren't to have this Monday morning meeting, would anything be different? And if nothing would be different, scrap the meeting.
If a leader truly recognizes that they are inherently a steward of others' time, they do meetings differently, right? They think carefully about what the meeting should cover. They think carefully about how that meeting should be facilitated. And we do this all the time when it comes to meetings we have with customers, right? When we meet with a customer, we think about that in advance. But when it comes to employee meetings, we just kind of dial it in. We rely on habits. And a great example is the research shows that 50% of agendas are recycled. We would never do that with customers.
My biggest piece of advice is, you know, if you're going to get people together in person when time is limited and resources are limited, gather around the things that you can't figure out over email.
So when you are thinking about your agenda, consider framing it not as topics to be discussed, but consider framing it as questions to be answered. By framing it as questions to be answered, it's easier to determine who needs to be there because they're relevant to the questions.
I feel like every time you call a meeting that involves a lot of people from different arenas, you are inevitably asking each of them to waste a lot of time.
You know, meetings are getting larger and larger and larger. Given this reality, there's a couple things that we can do. So first of all, we can actually design the agenda such that part of the agenda is relevant to a large group of individuals, and then part of it is relevant to a smaller section of that. So a big group attends for part of the meeting, and then people leave. And then it's a smaller group that has additional discussion. And what a leader can do is, once they start thinking about, you know, meeting attendees as being core versus secondary, that can be a very useful distinction.
Most of us have been raised with the age-old adage, the more the merrier. And for most gatherings, unless it's literally a rave, a soccer match, or a concert, the more is the hairier or the scarier.
Okay, I need some personal advice because I try to avoid meetings as much as possible. So I'm showing my bias. I don't typically enjoy meetings, but also because of what I do for a living, I just want my days unencumbered. I want my days for reading, writing, thinking, and interviewing people. And I don't want meetings. So sometimes they're unavoidable and sometimes, you know, they're great and useful. I don't mean to rain on them. But one thing I don't like is when you arrange a meeting with someone, it's usually via email, and then they send me a calendar invite. But I don't want somebody else's software living on my computer. And then every time there's an update to it, I get another alert. I don't want the distraction. Like, I took the time to plan the meeting. I know how to plan a meeting. I put it in my calendar. I'll be there. You don't feel my pain. That's okay. We can move on.
I actually think it's actually very deep. So we live in an age where you're talking about software, but basically we live in a multicultural, diverse, everybody is kind of their own island, but also all sorts of other things world. And we're all gathering all of the time. And gathering at some level is a form of imposition.
At some level, at every, no, sorry. Yes, yes, sorry. No, no, no.
Well, actually, what I love about how you're talking about it is it should be thought of as a form of imposition. And you only take the meetings or the gatherings where you think that you are willing to tolerate that imposition. And what you're talking about is, I actually think your instinct to say, I want to have my days free, I want to think, I want to write, I want to interview, is a much healthier instinct because you're raising the bar for anything to get through to you. And so for many of the companies and organizations I work with, I don't say gather more, I say gather better. And in many cases, that means gather less.
Coming up after the break, how to gather less and better, how to start your meeting, how to end it, and how to make sure that any physical violence is pre-planned.
We basically said, welcome back to the cage match.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Atlassian. Whether it's providing a single source of truth for thousands of employees or managing projects from start to finish, Atlassian works to unleash the potential of all types of teams with collaboration software. More at Atlassian.com. And by Progressive Insurance, providing tools designed to help customers consider options for multiple insurers. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Stephen Rogelberg, an organizational psychologist, and Priya Parker, a group conflict resolution facilitator, are trying to make your meetings less terrible. Okay, so how should you start a meeting? First example, how not to start.
So it starts late. A person arrives 10 minutes late, and then the leader says, okay, we can start now. Or worse yet, it's the leader herself or himself that shows up late. And then they start the meeting with a whole bunch of news and announcements, things that clearly could have been communicated in other mechanisms. Then the leader says, I have a really important issue to talk about. And they start talking about that issue and they dominate the discussion. And then another person in the meeting starts to dominate the discussion. And next thing you know, the leader looks at her or his watch and says, oh, gosh, we're out of time. But you know what? Let's run 10 minutes after the meeting time just to see if we can close the loop, and says, OK, look, I've heard from you all. But in effect, they've only heard from one or two people. And the other people either didn't have a chance to speak or were completely irrelevant to the discussion. So the meeting ends 10 minutes later than it should. The leader thinks that there was a good decision made, but no one else feels that way. And they go back to work and they go, oy vey, what just happened? It's called meeting recovery syndrome. And so what we find is that when people have bad meetings, they don't necessarily just leave it at the door. It sticks with them. They ruminate, they co-ruminate, and they even report it negatively affecting their productivity after the meeting.
Or you could start your meeting like this.
Don't open it with logistics. Open it. Spend the first 5 or 10 minutes connecting people in a specific way.
Here's an idea Parker got from someone who ran a weekly staff meeting.
She started her meetings by saying, let's everybody do a rose and a thorn, which is sort of this old exercise of like, what's the best part of your week? What's the worst part of your week? And it's just the first 10 minutes, the rest of the 50 minutes was used for, you know, business, quote unquote. And she called me up and she said, my meetings have transformed. And I said, why? And she said, people have started to say more real stuff in the context of work. Because by starting the meeting with including a thorn as the base default, I didn't realize I was playing a role as cheerleader. And they didn't think that I could handle or wanted to have 50-50 thorns. And so it's changed the norms of what's acceptable and what we talk about for the rest of the meeting.
So Priya, you write that businesses tend to, quote, run on a cult of positivity. What do you mean by that and how do you counter it?
Whether it is panels that are asking guests to talk about all of their successes or launch a product, or whether it is a meeting in which you're talking about how wonderful or how great things are. And so part of the unwinding of the cult of positivity is to go back and ask, what is the purpose of this gathering? And often positivity prevents progress.
Talk about the difference between generous authority and ungenerous, or as you term it, imperious authority.
Part of the role of a host is to practice generous authority. And I define generous authority to do three things with your guest. First is to connect them to each other and to the purpose, to protect them from each other, and to temporarily equalize them. Because in any type of group, people will fall into the default patterns that they always fall into, whether they know people or not. And your role as a host is to temporarily allow them to behave in a way that helps you collectively go to that purpose.
So if I'm a meeting leader, I can do different things. Instead of asking people to prepare in advance, you allocate the very first part of the meeting to reading the preparatory materials. Because at that point, at least you know everyone has done it. And then there's other unconventional tools. Like even if I have a large group of folks and I want them to engage strongly on a topic, if I have people pair up and work in dyads, even just for a few minutes, and then come back together as a group, me having folks work in dyad changes the whole dynamic of the large group discussion. The level of communication and passion will be much higher. But what we know from the research is that left to just the standard protocols of people talking, that a decision better than what would have just been produced by the best individual in the room only occurs 20% of the time. So most typically, meeting performance is just not optimal. The problem with meetings is that the proportion of good use of time and bad use of time is out of whack. And so I think that's the critical issue. It's just figuring out how can we increase the proportion of good time over bad time. Good time is when the attendees of the meeting are interacting in a genuine way such that the decisions and solutions being generated might surpass what any one individual could have done by themselves. And that time is not necessarily free of conflict. In fact, we want conflict in meetings. What we don't want is personal conflict, but we want conflict around ideas. So if you have a group going to battle with incredible passion around ideas, that is a fantastic meeting, especially if it's a safe environment and people go, wow, that was amazing that we could have this level of disagreement, but in a way that does not castrate everyone in the room.
Or, as Priya Parker put it earlier,
you know, unhealthy peace can be as threatening to human connection as unhealthy conflict. And most of our gatherings suffer from unhealthy peace, not unhealthy conflict.
So sometimes Parker has to invent some healthy conflict.
I was brought into an architecture firm, a 70-year-old architecture firm, to figure out their vision for the future. And they were debating whether to maintain being an architecture firm, which meant in their case, whether to continue to be like bricks and mortar building buildings or whether to pivot and become a design firm. And there was real disagreement in the firm, but you wouldn't know it by being in the room. And anytime someone would say something even related to one of the possible visions, everyone else would shrink back, right? They weren't willing to go there. And it was very polite. So during the coffee break, my client said to me, he literally whispered to me, Priya, we need more heat. And so we paused and thought, okay, basically the norm of politeness in this context is too strong for good controversy to happen through the way they normally meet. And so we quickly, in Photoshop, took two of the photos of the architect's head and slapped them on like wrestlers' bodies. We printed them out and put them on two walls. One side was the head, meaning design, and the other was the body, meaning the future would be architecture, bricks and mortar. And the architects came back and we basically said, welcome back to the cage match. In one corner, I was kind of like the MC. I was like, in one corner, you have the body. In the other, you have the head. And fortunately for us, the two architects were game. And so they started like jeering and like, you know, raising their hands over their shoulders. We assigned coaches to each of the sides. They threw white towels around their neck. We played the Rocky music, right? We interrupted the script. And I said, each side has 2 minutes to say the strongest possible argument for the future of the vision of the firm, whether it's architecture or design. And then they get 2 minutes for rebuttal. And everybody else, this was the key insight, everybody else has to physically choose a side. No neutrality and no wallflowers. And what that did was it broke the norm of implicit consensus, which there wasn't.
And what was the outcome of this architect cage match?
So at the end, the group voted and the best argument was the body.
And was that choice considered binding?
That choice was considered recommendational, but people knew that ahead of time. And so the deeper outcome of that meeting is that they have a shared memory that they are capable of this. They are capable of speaking in this way. You know, in any room, there's kind of troublemakers and smoother overs.
And the troublemaker plainly says, what I learned today is that we have too many meetings. That's the nature of the troublemaker?
Well, the troublemaker is a really useful role. Would you think of yourself as a smoother over or a troublemaker?
Who, me? You haven't figured that out by now? I am plainly the troublemaker.
So I think in healthy contexts, if you share a common purpose, troublemakers, quote unquote, can actually be really helpful. And one of the things that I often do in groups is have people raise their hand, who's a troublemaker, who's a smoother over, and then I ask, who's both? And people who are both, and there are always a few in a group, are the ones who are most likely to be part of transformational conversations. And that's because as a troublemaker, you're willing to poke and prod and you're not afraid of a little heat. But as a smoother over, you're also interested in repair coming together. And going back to our earlier conversation, most human connection and gathering suffer more from unhealthy peace than from unhealthy conflict. And in those contexts, if you're a group of smoother overs, I can diagnose immediately that this is a very unhealthy place.
I am happy to report that our listenership includes plenty of troublemakers as well as smoothers over. They've told us about some very successful meetings.
My name is Elise Piazza, and I'm a cognitive neuroscientist at Princeton University. I'm actually pretty lucky because I often hear people say, that was an awesome meeting. Lab meetings are opportunities for scientists to come together and share their latest data and then brainstorm next steps for the project. And occasionally we also discuss a recent, sometimes controversial journal article. I often come away feeling energized because I've thought of a new question to test, or an algorithm to implement. And sure, maybe science is inherently more fun and exploratory than other careers, but I think one of the reasons these meetings are so effective in general is that people with distinct skills and perspectives are coming together with the shared goal of helping their colleague improve.
And we heard about some less successful meetings.
Hey guys, my name is Al. So one of the worst meetings I've attended was when I was working on my startup. We came together for our weekly team meeting, and the goal was to come up with new ideas for our mobile app. And we just ran into a creative block. We weren't coming up with any good ideas. And I forgot whose idea it was, but one of my teammates suggested that we go outside and smoke some weed to get more creative. So we went behind the building, you know, like in the loading dock. All this got really high. And smoking weed was supposed to make us more creative, but in reality, it just made us really unproductive. And we just started hanging out and joking around. And I guess it made us better friends, but it wasn't really a great meeting.
We also heard from some listeners who've taken an entirely different path.
My name is John Cosgrove, and I live in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I moved here from Ireland 20 years ago. And about 7 years ago, I started a company, ironically, in the meetings and events industry. And in the last 7 years, we have not had a single meeting. And our company seems to be running very successfully.
Indeed, the reputation of meetings is so poor that many people simply avoid holding them. Mark Cuban and Elon Musk, for instance. Some companies have instituted no meeting days to give employees a chance to do their work without being dragged off to the conference room. But still, 55 million meetings a day in the U.S. That's the reality. Steven Rogelberg has found some other small measures to alleviate the pain. Snacks, of course. Getting people to switch out of the usual seats. Using anonymous surveys so people can raise objections without fear of reprisal. The research shows that just asking attendees to rate a meeting raises the quality of meetings at that firm. And what about when people sit through meetings staring at their phones?
One of the counterproductive behaviors we focused on was this idea of multitasking and really trying to understand why people multitask, despite the fact that clearly it tends to bother others. But then the other piece of it is multitasking as a coping mechanism. You know, when an employee walks into a meeting, they are relinquishing control. And so how can you get that control back? Well, you can daydream, you can make lists, or you can multitask. And so that's how you can reclaim your power. So one of the techniques is trying to build a break in the middle of a meeting. So if I tell them, hey, I promise you in 30 minutes you can check your phone, that's going to help put their minds at ease.
And one final important thing, how do you end a meeting?
First, issue a last call. So the same way that a bar has a last call, you know, they flash the lights or you literally say last call. And most meetings, most gatherings don't end. They stop, right? We run out of time, then we, like, everyone, you know, scatters.
You know when to end the meeting because the questions have been answered. And if you can't come up with any questions, you shouldn't have a meeting.
But then to help people understand when we go back out into the world, like, who's doing what? What was decided here? And are we all aligned?
People want to feel that their time was well spent. And this becomes a cue to tell you that indeed it was. If you know you have absolutely answered these compelling questions, then you leave there saying, ah, I accomplished something.
And to have a good memory at the end, which is like, what do you most want people to remember? And don't end on logistics. End on what you want people to remember.
All right. Job done then. Thanks, Priya Parker and Steven Rogelberg. Thanks to our anthropologist and behavioral ecologist friends and the African wild dogs, of course. And a big thanks to all the Freakonomics Radio listeners who sent us their meeting stories. Coming up after the break, I ask the psychologist Angela Duckworth a fairly simple question that somehow gets us deep in the weeds.
It's hard to tend 10 gardens.
And for more episodes like this one, subscribe to our podcast on any podcast app. You can find our entire 10-year archive on the Stitcher app or at Freakonomics.com, where we also publish transcripts and show notes. We'll be right back.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by TransferWise, a new way to manage money across borders. Over 6 million people and businesses use TransferWise to send, spend, and receive money internationally. More at TransferWise.com/Freakonomics or on the app. And by Indeed. With Indeed, employers can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on a short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
If you've been listening to this show for a while, there is a voice you may be familiar with by now.
I define grit as passion and perseverance for especially long-term goals.
Angela Duckworth is a psychology professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She's founder and CEO of the Character Lab, and she is a recurring guest on our show.
So is it true then that picky eaters and hypochondriacs are more likely to be politically conservative?
One thing she does really well is ask interesting questions. And I admire that trait since that's what we try to do every week on this show. So I thought it might be fun to just sit down with her and ask her something. Angela Duckworth, question for you.
All right, I'm ready.
Let's say that you personally are granted one genie wish, but it's multiple choice. You get to be in the top 1% globally in either grit or wealth or intellect. Grit, wealth, intellect. And now this is, let's say this is you are who you are, but not really.
I was are we talking about then you're going to be like in the bottom 1% of the other ones?
No. It's not that. And it's
I just get to like upgrade. in one dimension.
Yeah, let's say that. Well, right? No, that's tricky because you may already be, you may already consider yourself.
Gritty.
Right. So let's say no. Okay, let me rephrase the question. Not you, Angela Duckworth, you person.
Yeah, this is like the veil of ignorance that
exactly.
Like I'm a human.
Right, who came up with that?
It's is it Rawls?
Hume, Locke?
Rawls, I think.
Really?
Yeah, it's either Locke or Rawls.
It doesn't predate that? I thought it was like Ring of Gyges.
Oh my, no.
No?
I think the veil of ignorance is like, you know, within the last 200 years.
So let's say you put on the veil of ignorance
mm-hmm.
and you are a new entity and I say, you, O veiled one, get to be in the top 1% globally forever. In either grittiness,
mm-hmm.
intellect, or wealth, which do you choose and why? That's really what I want to know is the why.
I mean, honest answer, but predictable answer, I would choose grit.
Because?
Okay, so first of all, for wealth, I mean, I really just don't have any desire to be in the top whatever percenta of wealth. And I'm sure you could do a lot of good with that wealth, but it's just, it's never been, an appealing pursuit. So
maybe not for its own sake, but then...
Instrumentally, though. I know you were saying, like, you could do great good.
Right, or even if not great good, whatever the stuff you could hope to get with the grit or the intellect, couldn't you get a lot easier with the wealth?
You know, I think there's a huge difference, and my good friend, and you may know him, the psychologist Barry Schwartz has...
Paradox of choice.
The paradox of choice guy. So Barry Schwartz has something new that he's really obsessed about, and it is intrinsic motivation. And he would say, he calls it internal motivation, just to not be confused with, you know, what some people call intrinsic motivation. And basically he says, you know, if you have a garden and, you know, the garden is producing beautiful flowers and beautiful fruits and vegetables, and you tend to the garden, there's a kind of worth, value, and satisfaction that is derived that is different from if you like pay a gardener
yeah.
to like do your garden. And I think there is something about earning your accomplishments that I don't think wealth, because wealth is kind of instrumental, like, oh, I could pay somebody to, you know, accomplish this great research. It's different from doing it yourself.
Or, so I can't say I don't agree with you, or
okay.
I can't say that what
I
you
think
said
you wouldn't have chosen
doesn't
either, by the way.
Resonate.
Yeah.
Right. But on the other hand, I could argue, well, if I'm at the upper end in wealth, then I could afford to have 10 different gardens that I would tend myself and have all different kinds of experiments and experience to figure out. Let's say I believe that the satisfaction that you just described of producing yourself, let's say that that is the most valuable thing. Well, I've just increased my ability to have even more of that.
I have a portfolio of garden investments.
Exactly.
Even, right?
Well, not just investments, but a portfolio of gardening opportunities.
Oh, opportunities that you would then tend.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it's hard to tend 10 gardens.
Well, how do you know? You haven't tried it. You're not wealthy enough to have 10 gardens.
It. That's true. I'm not even wealthy
okay,
enough to have
one garden. Okay, but you're knocking
garden.
Out wealth. You're knocking out
wealth. Right.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm not like passing moral judgment on anybody who wants to be wealthy.
Intellect, you're also knocking out. Now, we should say you're...
Now, that was the horse race. That's where
well,
I was
you're,
like, oh,
and you're
no.
a pretty smart cookie, I have to say.
Thank you. Okay, so here's what my husband would say of me. Right. So my husband thinks that the great irony is that I have spent my entire professional career studying everything other than IQ. In fact, my doctoral dissertation is called non-IQ predictors of success. Right. So I study all these non-IQ things like grit and delayed gratification and growth mindset. And, you know, and so the irony my husband thinks is that really I'm personally kind of obsessed with intelligence and that I love it. And I, you know, wish I had more of it. And that, you know, I really enjoy people who are just, you know, wicked smart.
And you seek out and accord higher status to people who are wicked smart, even if they don't seem that high status in other realms?
I really love talking to people who are fast. And that
fast?
Yeah, like their brain. And I know that's not the only way to be smart, but just that their brain moves really quickly. And you're like, oh, you know, and then like, you know, it doesn't take them that long to process a thought and then move on to the next one. So he's right about that. But I didn't pick it, you know, not just so I can be like consistent with my brand, but I do think if you you made it multiple choice, Stephen, so I can't really like, you know, say that I wouldn't want to be smarter too. But in the long, long run, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of really smart people who don't accomplish much. But in the long, long run, I don't think there are that many people who are just, you know, the epitome of passion and perseverance who don't, you know, do something.
Are you sure? I mean, isn't the world full for sure. of people that we don't know about? Despite the fact that they've been super gritty and they've exercised, as you just ticked off, perseverance and passion, and yet didn't, quote, accomplish enough to become known.
Well, this is the thing about multiple choices, right? Like, you know, you're...
Oh, now you're blaming the test.
Yeah, I'm blaming the test. I'm blaming the test maker. I'm blaming you, Stephen.
True,
okay,
fair.
So here's the thing, though, right? Because I think in a multiple choice where you're forced to pick one, you know, really on any of these, you could say, well, what if? Because I think actually what we want to be in life, you, me, and everyone else, is, you know, we probably want to be more than one thing. So you're right. Grit isn't the only thing you need, you know, to be happy and successful. But if you have grit and, you know, good judgment, or, you know, grit and humility, grit and a big heart. So you're right. It's not the only thing. But, you know, neither is intelligence the only thing.
Sure.
Right? So there
sure.
you go.
Well, let me rephrase the question slightly then. Mm. Think about the purpose, I guess, of life.
Mm.
And what you think is the highest purpose, or it doesn't have to be one thing, right?
Yeah.
What you believe to be kind of...
My highest purpose, you mean?
Right. So let's say that in order to successfully reach or fulfill that purpose as best as you can, which of the following then would be most useful in pursuit of said purpose? Mm. Grit, intellect, or money?
Mm. Again, you're making me pick one, which I get it.
Well,
right?
But first tell us, what do you see as, what's the purpose of life?
What's
the purpose of
my life?
Yeah.
I'm just going to use that big qualifier there because I don't want,
sure.
right? It's
fair
not,
enough.
You know, not for me to tell you about your life. I think the purpose of my life is to achieve something. In other words, I do not think that the purpose of my life is to do something like be the happiest person or have the most experiences. You know, I remember distinctly the day I was taking a walk with my dad. I was, you know, young enough to still be like holding his hand and looking up. So I don't know how old I was, but I was a little girl. And I asked him, so I was old enough to ask him this question. I asked him if he was happy. And he stopped, because every time he had to answer a question, he would just stop walking. It was very annoying. We didn't get very far, very many days. And he said, why would I want to be happy? I want to be successful. So I do think I inherited my father's sort of like, life is about accomplishing something important. And for me, it's, you know, I want to help kids, like, lead a healthy life. But I don't really think like, oh, I want to, you know, I haven't been to that country. Like, I want to see what that, you know, restaurant is like. I don't care that much about like that kind of happiness.
And do you feel that you're driven toward that kind of accomplishment out of generosity and good-heartedness, or because, look, you've accomplished a lot in your life. Your CV reads like a track record of a successful person, right?
Mm.
Great institutions of learning, great accomplishments, da-da-da-da-da. You have a job, da-da-da, nice family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
Is it that you want to help other people, like I said, out of generosity, altruism, or because you derive great pleasure and even, dare I say, happiness from the feeling of accomplishment?
So Kant, Immanuel Kant or Kant, depending on how you want to pronounce it, said, I think, that if you do something good because it brings you pleasure, right, because it feels good to do good, then it doesn't count, right? And I remember when I, like, learned this, I was taking justice, you know, moral reasoning. It was, like, my freshman year in college. And I remember thinking, like, oh, what a guy thing to say. Like, I feel like it's, like, you know, such a, like a, oh, if it's not rational and it's not, like, you know, only because it's a moral principle. I actually think that a lot of our most benevolent and honorable motivations come from like a kind of visceral, like it feels good. So when you ask me the question, like, oh, why do I care about kids? Like, I really like them. I mean, you know, give me a random kid. I just like them. Give me a random adult. Like, I don't know. I often like them, but not as often as I like kids. So I do get a lot of just like, I don't know, selfish enjoyment from being with kids and like the idea that you could make some kids out there like happier. So there's a, you know, I don't think it's a, you know, purely, you know, an unemotional motive.
I really appreciate that distinction you just made. And it makes me think, you know, back to the kind of grit theory of life, which is without a passion for something, then it becomes a little bit of a, you know, accomplishment for accomplishment's sake or success for success's sake, right?
I mean, I think you can be a gritty person who's using all your grit for bad. I mean, let me just be clear. Like, I don't want to say
Hitler was gritty.
Yes. The canonical sort of, you know, everyone rolls out Hitler as the example of like, oh, but then again, there was Hitler. But in this case, yes.
Sorry, if my example is a cliche. Stalin was also
Hitler,
gritty.
Because, yes, okay. Stalin. Let's take Stalin for a little variety. Mm-hmm. But no, seriously, I think in general, one of the things that really motivates people to stay committed to something for a long time is feeling like you're part of something
something bigger than yourself. Now, again, you can be misguided, but very, very often it is a kind of like benevolent, you know, like, oh, this isn't just for me kind of motivation. That also, it's maybe not your only fuel, but it's also one of the things that motivates you. So for me, like, yeah, I would pick grit because I feel like I would be able to achieve what I want to do with my life, which is to accomplish something for kids. Intelligence, I think, would also be awesome if you made it two choices. Of course, I'd pick intelligence probably as my second choice. But, you know, why don't I just be the gritty person who gets all the smart people to work on this project? That's what is basically my strategy in life.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. If you want more of our show, subscribe to the podcast on any podcast app. Give it a 5-star rating while you're at it. If you want to learn more about Freakonomics, there's a website, freakonomics.com. There's an email newsletter. There are transcripts and download links for every episode we've ever made. We are also on social media and even email at radio@freakonomics.com. Talk to you soon.